This is the Roots of Rock monthly jam session. Here's your host, Sean Tompkins.
Hey, I'm Sean Tompkins. Welcome to the January 2018 Roots of Rock monthly jam session. Hope you had a great time during the holidays. Christmas, New Year's, all of it. Hopefully you got to, you know, stuff your face and get spoiled with some good presents, all while spending quality time with family and friends, of course. 2018 promises to be just as interesting and crazy as 2017, so buckle up, get a helmet, enjoy the ride. This is going to be a really fun episode. The last podcast that we released at the beginning of January was the full feature episode on Queen. Now, a good friend of mine is a massive Queen fan. I had a chance to talk to her about Queen and her super fandom. She's got some real insight and passion for the band. So I just love talking to people like that. Her name is Sasha Spencer, and I talked to her earlier in the week, and it's all part of the show today. I'm really excited to share it with you. And you know, over the holidays, I ended up listening to a lot of podcasts because I was on the road a lot. And one of the standouts that I really enjoyed was called The Thread. The producers of that show clearly have a similar mindset to what we do here at Roots of Rock. They start with a historic event and then trace it back through history, all while following one thread all the way back to another really significant event in history. It was really compelling to listen to, and I loved hearing how interconnected so many people and events were. It's really crazy to think how the world can change in a really significant way with one little quirk of history. I encourage you to go out and check out that podcast. On this, their inaugural season, they started with the assassination of John Lennon and traced the history all the way back to Vladimir Lenin. Since the theme of that first season was kind of a musical one with the whole John Lennon tie-in, I thought it would be cool to chat with them about that podcast. I had that chance to talk with the host, Sean Braswell, earlier in the week. So we're going to get to that in a minute. But first, let's go to my buddy Poncho Parker and find out what history is being made right now in rock and roll.
Linkin Park singer Mike Shinoda has released three new tracks as a digital EP. One of those is called Looking for an Answer. He wrote shortly after the death of his Linkin Park bandmate Chester Bennington. It marks the first new music made by one of the surviving members of the band since Bennington took his own life last July. Greta Van Fleet is now in the studio recording their first full-length album with a late spring or early summer release. The album will feature songs pulled from an archive of tracks. Guitarist Jake Kiska said the band has a lot of material to choose from. Jack White has announced a ban on mobile phones at shows on his upcoming tour, revealing that his concerts will be, quote, a phone-free 100% human experience. He says he sees social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter as venues that destroy music's mystique.
Those are not romantic tools. I don't see how they could be romantic. Ease of use, there's no doubt about that. You can't argue the ease of use and the click and instantaneous gratification. But I felt a lot better when I was trying to find, like, I couldn't find a Led Zeppelin t-shirt when I was a kid. I don't even know where I would go to get one in Detroit. Now you can get it at Walmart, which is great. I'm glad those kids are getting turned on to it, but I also, there has to be other things involved that they can search out for and get for themselves and not just have it handed to them. Because as soon as you click on something, what do? 5 seconds later, you click off of it.
I'm Poncho. That's your Rock Flash.
Thank you, Poncho. Now, let's get back to earlier in the week when I spoke to the host of the Thread podcast, Sean Braswell. Hi, this is Sean Tompkins with Roots of Rock, and today we are lucky to be joined by Sean Braswell, host of the podcast, The Thread. Sean, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sean.
So can you start off by telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Sean Braswell. I'm a writer for Aussie Media, which is sort of a startup magazine focused on the new and the next, sort of new trends, rising stars, new people. But also we do a bit of history, and we embarked last year on our first history podcast called The Thread, and so I'm the host of that podcast as well.
Yeah, I have to say, I listened to that podcast over the holidays, and I gobbled it up. I really enjoyed it. Can you take our listeners through how you chose to tell your story? You call it The Thread. Can you tell us why and how that works?
Sure. I guess it's sort of a bit like sliding doors or 6 degrees of separation. The idea is basically to start with a famous event or a big figure or a big idea, and to sort of pull on the thread and find out the sort of set of dominoes, of history's dominoes, that sort of led up to that event. And so you sort of tell the story in reverse chronological order. So, for example, in season one, we looked at the murder of John Lennon, whose killer, Mark David Chapman, had been inspired in part by reading The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. And so we sort of the next step in that link then was to look at how The Catcher in the Rye came about and the sort of origin story for the novel and for its author, J.D. Salinger. And so from sort of there, you just sort of, sort of leapfrog back through history, one story at a time, finding key influences and different connections through history. It's really just, sort of an interesting way to tell interconnected biographies. Ralph Waldo Emerson, I think, once said, there is no history, only biography. And so it really is a biography podcast, but we have sort of this overarching conceit, if you will, that allows us to connect these different lives together and keep people guessing a little bit about where we're going.
So were you aware of that thread that joined all these stories together, or did you find that as you researched the stories for the show?
Yeah, well, I generally start with a sort of initial layer of research, just looking at different possibilities, different connections, and finding a lot of dead ends. Most things dead end.
Right.
I think a lot of people think if you look for a connection in history, you can connect any two figures together, and that's probably the case. But you probably won't find strong connections, and so to really find a thread that actually works, where you have some meaningful and significant relationships between people, it takes some digging. So I'd usually do some preliminary research and sort of find the outlines of a possible thread. And then what I like to do is basically read five or six books about each of the different subjects, pretty much sort of simultaneously. So I sort of have a holistic view of how this sort of whole overarching story fits together and all the component pieces.
And so what made you focus this season and this one on the assassination of John Lennon?
I think it's always been an event that has fascinated me, and such a tragic event too. And I always was particularly fascinated by the fact that Mark David Chapman, his killer, had long regarded Lennon as sort of a personal hero. And so, the main question for me was, what would make someone kill their hero? And obviously, he was not he was a sick individual, and
right.
There were lots of issues in his life. But delving deeper into it, you sort of start to see how he glommed on to The Catcher in the Rye and the protagonist Holden Caulfield in that book as sort of almost a spokesman for his neurotic behavior. And it was, I don't know if there's an organizing theme to Chapman's madness, I suppose it's The Catcher in the Rye. So it sort of went back from there, and I just independently been doing some stories on J.D. Salinger, because there had been a new round of Salinger biographies in the wake of his death, and people were starting to learn a lot more about Salinger and his life and some of the ins and outs there. So that was sort of also in my mind, and then I just started to think about tying those two islands together.
So you mentioned Mark David Chapman and his obvious mental health issues. And in the podcast, you told the story of how in the events leading up to the assassination of John Lennon, he started to see signs and synchronicities around him. Things like the Dakota building that he was hanging out in front of where John Lennon was staying was the set for Rosemary's Baby, which was a movie produced by Roman Polanski, whose wife was killed by a cult inspired by Beatles songs. And he had a way in his own mind of putting these things all together and believing that they were signs. Do you think that those signs and synchronicities, as you put it, do you think they're around everyone all the time? Or is it just a really crazy coincidence, or just the brain of someone like Mark David Chapman who was able to see something like that?
Yeah, I think there are coincidences and connections all over the place out there, but it sort of takes a human mind to put them together. And on the one end of the spectrum, I think we all do it from time to time. We tend to read order into the chaos, but on the other end of the spectrum, you get conspiracy theorists and people like Mark David Chapman who are willing to make those connections, and oftentimes they're connections that sort of support their particular worldview or what they're really looking to do themselves.
Right. Do you think it's fate then, or are they coincidences?
Yeah, I don't think I really believe in fate or destiny sort of as a concept. To me that implies there might be sort of an invisible hand or a supernatural force that's injecting itself into sort of a cause and effect relationship. But I do believe in fate as sort of a way of analyzing history or looking backwards.
Sure.
At events that have happened and sort of seeing, like I said, where the dominoes have fallen and how one thing leads to another. And, you know, there was no external force that might have made that happen, but it happened. And I think it's just interesting to look back almost like a forensic scientist or detective sort of looking back at how the pieces fit together.
You know, I was really, really interested in Una O'Neill in your podcast. I'd never heard of her before, which I found quite surprising because she's a really fascinating and compelling character, and especially given the company that she kept and just her own personal history, it was very interesting. So can you tell our listeners, who also may not be aware of who she is, just exactly who she was and how she kind of fit into your story?
Sure. So Una O'Neill is one of those, or Una O'Neill Chaplin, as she later became known, as one of those figures from just sort of lurking in the shadows of history. And, she was a wealthy New York City debutante, the daughter of a very well-known American playwright named Eugene O'Neill, but who had basically abandoned her and had very little to do with her life, so she was sort of trying to make it on her own. But of course, later on, she was J.D. Salinger's girlfriend. She became Charlie Chaplin's wife after leaving J.D. Salinger. And ultimately, she was also one of the inspirations for the character of Holly Golightly in Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's. So she, is sort of just, in the orbit of all these major American artists of the 20th century, but not someone whose story you necessarily knew before.
Was there a particular book on her? Like, is there a biography on her that you found that you used to research her?
Yeah, there's a wonderful biography called Una, Living in the Shadows, appropriately enough, by a woman named Jane Scoville, who we interviewed in the Una O'Neill episode.
Any hint for the theme of season two of The Thread?
So we focused on that sort of tragedy as the we focused on a tragedy as sort of our launching pad in season one, and we're turning to look at a historic figure, the origins of a historic figure in season two. In this case, the feminist icon Gloria Steinem, and just sort of pulling the thread on what led to her rise, which has some surprising twists and turns, and some other major American icons behind her story.
Oh, very good. Thanks, Sean. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, happy to join you. Thanks for having me.
Well, where can people find you online?
Oh, you can find me and as well as the Thread podcast on ozzy.com. That's OZY.com and on our Facebook and Twitter pages as well.
And now a message from someone who's not our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Linda Johnson, president of the Association of Meaningless Studies. When I started this company 8 years ago, I had one goal in mind, and that was to inform the public of the most meaningless information through scientific study. Do you ever wonder how many pomegranates you'd have to eat before your colon collapsed on itself? I know, probably not. It's 43. You see, someone has to do the work behind all those studies that you seem to hear about every day. Our newest study shows that ketchup is the condiment of choice in households with four or less people over the age of three in Western Belgium. I bet you never thought you'd need to know that. And you're probably right about that. But that little tidbit of information just took the space in your brain that used to be reserved for remembering your brother's birthday. You're welcome! You can count on us to deliver pointless results because we employ a dedicated team of scientific researchers that are passionate about finding out the information that no one else seems to care to find. In fact, we take great pride in using government dollars to research things like, are cats a solid or a liquid? You'll have to tune in to the morning news tomorrow to find out the answer to that one. Also, Did you know that male platypuses don't get the hiccups? Our top researchers spent millions of dollars figuring that one out. Groundbreaking, yet pointless, just the way we like it. I'm Linda Johnson, happy to serve you the results of studies you didn't think you needed. You're welcome.
Hey, back at the start of the month, we released the podcast version of the Roots of Rock full feature episode of Queen. And I thought it would be really cool to talk to someone who's a massive Queen fan, someone who really loves the band. And my friend from one of our sister stations in Calgary, Sasha Spencer, is the biggest Queen fan that I know. And we are very lucky to have her join us on the show right now. Sasha, welcome to Roots of Rock.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm actually, like, I don't know, I'm super excited just to talk about Queen. Some people, like, when I was growing up, my mom, like, rolled her eyes every time that I'd be like, Mom, guess what? Queen is the best. So I'm glad you want to listen to me about this.
So this has been something that has been with you lifelong since you were a kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, I remember I got really into Queen. I mean, it was after their heyday and after Freddie Mercury had died, maybe a couple years after. But I was really young. It was like the early 90s. And if you remember, it was a time when CDs were first coming out, but nobody had CD players in their car yet.
Right.
So you had to just, you know, record from your CD player onto a mixtape and then put that in your tape deck. And I remember my mom had Queen's Greatest Hits on CD, and she was recording from CD onto tape. And I was like three, four years old, and I remember We Will Rock You came on, and as a kid, that's the best song ever, because stomping and clapping when you're that young is just the greatest. And I was like stomping along with the song, and the CD kept skipping. And my mom was getting so mad. Like, Sasha, I'm just trying to make a mixtape. Get out of here. So it really started there. And then, you know, I kind of went away from it for a while. And then you mentioned in your podcast before that when you saw Wayne's World, that really kicked things off for you.
Right. Yeah. That was my same thing. Actually, We Will Rock You, I think that was the first one that I really got into. I remember being a kid and some kid on my bench in hockey one day did the thing where you stomp one foot, the other foot, so you get the three beat for We Will Rock You, and we do that with your, you know, the stomp with your feet and clap with your hands. So that was the first one I remember too. And then I remember really getting into Bohemian Rhapsody when I saw it in Wayne's World.
Yeah, and everything was so out of order for me, and I apologize for this because some people might think this is really sacrilegious, but I actually, like, I love Mike Myers, and I actually started off my love for him with all the Austin Powers movies. And then I went back to Wayne's World and actually saw Wayne's World 2 before the first one. And then, yeah, when I was watching the first Wayne's World, like, I knew of Queen, obviously, like, I grew up listening to it.
Right.
And I didn't really know really of Bohemian Rhapsody until I saw that. And then I just dove headfirst, and I went crazy. Like, when I was, like, 14, 15, for about those 2 years, I listened exclusively to Queen. Nothing else. And even I remember in grade 9, I had 4 binders, and every binder I put a picture of each member in each binder. And like Brian May is, you know, he's really smart and what is it, astronomy? Yes. I always want to say astrology, but it's not the horoscope one.
Right.
He's really into astronomy.
An actual and science.
So, yeah, I was like, I'll put him in my science binder. That makes. So, yeah, I was crazy about them. And even, I'm a huge Coronation Street fan. And I became a Coronation Street fan because of their video for I Want to Break Free, where they dress in drag and they make fun of Coronation Street. And my fandom of Queen has easily come from, it's easily shaped my life, honestly.
So this is going to be a two-part question. Do you currently have a favorite era /album/song for the band, and has that evolved over the years from, say, teenager to now? Has that changed over time?
I think when I started, I start like most people who discover a band kind of after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I started off listening to We Will Rock You, Bicycle Race, Fat Bottom Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got deeper into it, I, you know, started discovering B-sides and unreleased songs. And my favorite era is definitely their heavier stuff from the beginning. My favorite album, I would say, is Queen 2, because you really hear, when you listen to it, you can tell that, like, something's brewing, that something big will happen really, really soon. And, like, a song like The March of the Black Queen, there's so many multi-layers in it. It's a pretty long song. I think it's about 5.5 minutes. And when you listen to it, you're just like, oh, yeah, obviously Bohemian Rhapsody is coming.
Yeah, there's a there's a prelude to it.
Absolutely. And at the time, too, like, Freddie Mercury was writing really weird stuff, honestly. Like, I know you played Great King Rat before.
Mm-hmm.
And Fairy Fellers Masterstroke, like, he had a very, like, mythical way of writing. And everything, and Brian May, all the stuff that he was writing was just, I found, you know, obviously written from the guitar and just really, really heavy. And I like it. I mean, I like everything. Like, it's kind of hard as a Queen fan to, you know, you find good in everything, even their worst albums, which, you know, we don't have to talk about, but we can. You find, like, a good point in some of them.
What do you think? What do you rate as their worst album? Since you brought it up.
Yeah, I know. Well, an amazing song comes from it, and that's Under Pressure, but Hot Space is hot garbage.
What about the band's lyrical content? Do you like it? Do you not like it? Does it add to the music? Or are they just so talented musically that the lyrics are secondary?
I would say that, like, that's an interesting question. I never really thought about it, but I would say that their music is on the forefront. Like, lyrics almost come second.
Mm-hmm.
And Freddie Mercury really talked about how, when he wrote songs, he wasn't, you know, trying to be like a John Lennon 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he wasn't making a statement. He didn't want to change the world in any sort of way by, you know, coming up with something super profound.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can listen to certain songs, and Good Old Fashioned Lover Boy, to me, would be an example of a very simple song. Just really easy formula. They're not, you know, saying anything groundbreaking.
Sure.
It's a nice little ditty. But they definitely, like, expanded on stuff that was going on. Like, We Are the Champions, there's an interesting lyric in that one where it is, you brought me fame and fortune and everything that goes with it, I thank you all. That line in the song, it doesn't fit. Like, with the syllables and the way the rhyming is going, it doesn't work.
Right.
But somehow they made it work. So, it just really depends on what song you look at. Some are very simplistic. Some, there's a little bit more going on. But, yeah, I would say, like, lyrically, maybe Queen is, maybe that's more of a secondary thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's some bands that I find, like, I always think, when I think of lyrics, I think of Van Halen for some reason. Especially the David Lee Roth era, where amazing talent, great musicianship, the songs are catchy, the guitar playing's out of this world. The lyrics are horrible. Like, it just, when you read them on paper, it's the least poetic thing, but it doesn't matter almost, because it's such good music. And I wouldn't put Queen in that category, but yeah, I'd agree with that. I think you're right that the lyrics are not, like you say, if he's not trying to be John Lennon, you're not going for a deep insight, but it doesn't matter because the music's so good anyway that the lyrics don't have to be overly complex and you don't have to think about those in that way.
Exactly, yeah.
So what about the new version of Queen with Adam Lambert? Have you listened to them? What's your opinion on that version of the band?
I've seen them twice.
Really?
That show twice.
Where?
Both in Edmonton,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the first time they announced that they were going on tour, Queen and Adam Lambert, I remember being this. I was so torn. because, you know, you grew up with an image of Queen, but Queen was, when they were touring, it was before I was born.
Sure.
So my image of Queen, I have seen them live in a sense. Like, I have a bunch of concert DVDs, but obviously I've never seen them in person.
Right.
And I was so scared to go and see them and ruin, I guess, what I had built up in my mind.
Sure, yeah. I can relate to that.
Yeah, but I decided that I should go just to check it out. And the first time I saw them, it was amazing. The second time was really good too, but I found Adam Lambert, and bless his heart, and I actually really appreciate that. He says in his show, like, okay, let's address this elephant in the room. I know you're all sitting there thinking, well, he's no Freddy. And no kidding.
Yeah.
And he's not trying to be, and I appreciate that.
Ridiculously big shoes to fill.
Absolutely. But the one thing that I didn't like when I saw them the second time is I find that Adam is getting more comfortable, which is okay. But I appreciated the first time I saw them because I felt like Adam Lambert, he knew, like, okay, I'm just going to be here to just kind of carry the tune.
Right.
I'm going to let these professionals, well, not that he's not a professional, but...
I know what you mean.
Yeah, I'm going to let Brian May and Roger Taylor really, really shine. And then, yeah, the second time I saw them, it was just, there was just too much Adam Lambert.
Mm-hmm.
He does a great job, but the one thing... The one takeaway that I would say from this whole thing is, like, if you ever have an opportunity to see your favorite artists, like the Eagles are going on tour again, and it's not the whole package, I would still say you gotta go.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't, I don't see it when I go to a Queen and Adam Lambert show, I don't see it as I'm going to Queen and Adam Lambert. I look at it as, I'm going to go watch Roger Taylor and Brian May.
Right.
Two amazing musicians that I grew up absolutely in love with. And that's what I really focus on. And like kind of I guess more mainstream Queen fan, there's a point in their shows, Queen and Adam Lambert, where Brian May just kind of goes out on the catwalk and it's just him and his guitar. And he does really beautiful, beautiful acoustic songs that Freddie used to, like, have such a good time with at concerts and have such intimate moments with people at their shows. And, yeah, for kind of a mainstream Queen fan, those are lesser-known songs, and they usually get up, and that's when you go to the bathroom or grab a drink.
Right.
And that was where, to me, like, I remember sitting there crying and just being like, this is so amazing, because it's just Brian May, and it was such a nice time to just... focus on him. So I don't regret ever going, but I do remember being so torn when they first announced, hey, we're going on tour with Adam Lambert. But it's good. They're so good.
Do you think, I mean, they've tried their best to recreate what they had in the past. Do you think that the era that created Queen in their original form, Can that be replicated in today's modern age? Can there ever be another band like them?
I do think that there are some bands that really embrace kind of that androgynous, campy, operatic rock. There's The Darkness, there's Foxy Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I think Queen did that, actually the Beatles really started. And some people might argue that, you know, like pure rock fans might argue that this is garbage, but the Beatles were the first artists to really use the studio as more than just a recording mechanism. They used it as an instrument.
Right.
And Queen, I think, took that to the next level, like Bohemian Rhapsody. How many multi-tracks did they do with that? They really learned to overlay a bunch of things. So, and some might even argue that there were certain times in Queen's career where their sound was maybe overproduced. And then I think a lot of music today can kind of toe that line too, where things might be a little bit overproduced. And so I think in a way, just using the studio and using the tools at hand in the studio, you can sort of create not definitely nothing like Queen, but just sort of that idea of just using the studio to your full advantage.
I'm sure, yeah. Hey, you know, the reason I asked that question is because I thought a lot about that question in particular with new bands, and my thought on it is that it's very hard for a new band to do something original, because so many have come before them and done things like that, right? So now, even if you are a band doing, you know, something like you say, using the studio as another instrument in their band, it's been done by how many bands before? So the inevitable thing for people to do is to compare them to that old band.
Yeah.
It's really hard, I think, for a band in today's day and age to be original and new.
I agree, absolutely.
So do you have any little bit of cool trivia or history, anything you want to add about the band you can tell us?
And I don't know if this would come as a surprise to someone who just grew up exclusively listening to Queen, but because I also, you know, have all their concert DVDs and I watched all their music videos, I was floored when I found out that John Deacon, the bass player, didn't sing at all. Because when you watch the music videos and the concerts, he has a mic, he's doing something. But then I found out, like, they always just, you know, had it there kind of as a prop. And they wanted to include him, especially in the music videos when you're just lip syncing anyway.
Right.
And but they always had his mic unplugged in concert. But the guy is such a genius. Like, John Deacon, Brian May has such a unique guitar sound. And because John Deacon, he graduated from, like, he's a graduate of electronics or something like that, like when he joined the band Queen. So he went into Brian May's amp and created a whole new amp, the Vox Deaky amp. And that's the amp Brian May still uses, and it gives his guitar that extra little whine.
Wow.
So, yeah. And then I just find John Deacon, like, I wish he would have written more, because he didn't write a ton of songs, and especially in comparison to Brian May. Freddie Mercury, and Roger Taylor wrote quite a bit, in comparison to all of them, John Deacon hardly wrote, but when he wrote, they were massive songs. Like, he wrote You're My Best Friend, Another One Bites the Dust, Spread Your Wings, I Want to Break Free. He did the bass line for Under Pressure. Like, he was super talented and smart. I have to appreciate too, like, he's still alive. He's just really gone away, because after Freddie died, he was like, I don't have a reason to keep going.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I just totally respect John Deacon, and I think, like, not enough people really consider that he was a huge part of Queen, even though I just don't think he enjoyed the limelight as much as the rest of them did. So he kind of, you know, and I think a lot of bass players are like that. They kind of take a backseat a little bit, but a super, super talented musician.
I know a lot of bass players. I think you're right. I think they have inferiority complex.
And they're kind of like goalies in hockey. Like, they're just here, you know?
Just there to keep. Well, you think they're just there to keep the rhythm, but a good bass player makes all the difference in a band.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Sasha. We really appreciate you coming on.
Well, it was fun. Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye.
This has been the Roots of Rock Monthly Jam Session for January 2018. Be sure to subscribe and give us a rating on whatever podcast player you may have found us on. Check us out on Twitter, at Roots of Rock ST is our handle, or go old school and shoot me an email, rootsofrock@rci.rogers.com. Maybe you've got some cool bit of trivia or history or great concert story you want to share about a band that we've talked about on Roots of Rock. If so, let me know, and we want to get you on the show and hear your story. Stay tuned for the beginning of February, when we will have a brand new Roots of Rock full feature podcast and tons of cool stuff coming up in the new year. A special thanks to everyone who joined me today. Sasha, Sean, and Poncho, thank you very much. And a very special thanks to Alex Zuretsky for all the technical production on the Roots of Rock Jam Sessions. Thanks for hanging out.